Our next speaker is Colin Fox.
Thanks, Karen.
What?
No, thanks.
From the University of Auckland. So, Colin,
Thanks very much, Gary. Well, I want to say, first of all, how it's a pleasure to be here, and being the South Pacific representative in the Pacific Institute of Math Studies.
No, that's not
oh, is there another? Oh, sorry. But I must admit, so I wasn't, I didn't get that right, but I'm wondering how come all the guys from Calgary are here. I mean, okay, that's enough. What I'd like to talk talk to you today about is statistical estimation for inverse problems. I guess I should be upfront and say that I'm a card-carrying Bayesian, and I don't have it. I'm sorry, but other than that, and that I think that. An inferential framework is a good framework for analysing inverse problems, and it's certainly, I think, a kind of a comprehensive framework. And the key issue really about the inferential methods is that they take an explicit account of the noise process that you have in measurements. And really that's the one extension on the things that I think many people do. And so it's not fundamentally different, I think, in terms of the goals, but... That most people here do, but the issue of considering noise, I think, is actually crucial. So, in my world, I mainly do image analysis, or image reconstruction. So, statistical estimation of parameters of PDE. To me, the PDE is something about a forward map, and the parameters are actually a picture I'm trying to make. So, I always talk in terms of image recovery nomenclature. So, I talk about my truth as an image. So here's image space over here, and it gets mapped to data space, as I call it, or some people call it measurements. But this image could be anything. It could be the parameters you're looking for. It could be the sound speed profile under the ground. It could be whatever it is you're after. Now, in most of our analysis, what we think is there's a true image somewhere, so some point in image space, and it gets mapped to a point of data space by this forward map, or direct map, perhaps we should call it. But the key thing I want you to know is that always the data has some kind of fuzz of ambiguity about it. So here's the true data, if you like, that would be noise-free, and there's some fuzz of ambiguity because when you make measurements, unfortunately, we don't know anything exactly in this world, you know. And so that implies that there's some... And so it means that we actually typically don't measure the true data. We measure another piece of data which is somewhere within this fuzz. And if we were to look at this piece of data and the data that we actually measure and take into account the ambiguity and so forth, that means that there's some kind of fuzz in image space that are feasible images, and with any luck, the true image is in there. But that's a little bit of a moot point about whether we have access to this true image or not. Hopefully it's within this range. But what I want to show you really is that taking into account this noise process is, first of all, you can do it, you can take into account the uncertainty in a quantitative way, so there's no kind of magic about it. Second of all, that in some ways it's actually necessary to take into account this noise, that certain inverse problems, are fundamentally different in the presence of noise to without noise. Now, there are certain cases like X-ray tomography, for instance, where you can solve the problem ignoring noise, and you're going to get a relatively good answer. But there's plenty of problems, for instance, the seismic inversion cases, where noise is actually critical and it fundamentally changes the nature of the problem. Now, maybe that's just something I want you to take on faith for a wee while. And then the last thing I really want to show is that by being aware of the noise and taking it into account explicitly, you can do inversion, you can compute with this stuff. You can make efficient inversion algorithms. And furthermore, because of the kind of technology we use, the means of representing images are far more general than the kind of structures that you're stuck with when you do things like regularization. So that it gives us means of modelling the images, of representing them, in ways that are far more relevant, typically, to the interpreter. So, for instance, in the seismic case, you could make a direct model that says, I know the ground is made up of rocks, and they have a certain range of acoustic speeds, and so forth. OK, Okay, so what I'll show you in this talk is, I'll just give you a little bit of nomenclature, perhaps it's not so important. I'll show you how the statistical model for inverse problems arise. That's a natural thing. Show you how that gives you some interpretations, give you the traditional approaches, and then I'll kind of home in on a particular example, which is something that I like because it's a kind of canonical difficult problem, is recovering electrical conductivity using these things. So here's a slide that I don't think will teach you anything, but perhaps it just tells you the words that I use for inverse problems. So here's a canonical inverse problem up here, you know, an X-ray problem where you've got some object that you're trying to image the electron density, as it turns out with X-rays. And you pass X-rays through it and so forth, and you make measurements for certain collections of positions of the X-ray source and sensors. As it turns out, I'm mainly interested in problems that are not like this, where I'm more interested in cases where you can't use the Born approximation, so where the scattering is dense in the medium. So like in the seismic case, where the paths, or the rays, if you like, were curved, or more to the point where typically there aren't single rays, but there are distributions of paths that the energy takes. And what can you infer from the innards from that? And typically in those cases, you have to solve a PDE to simulate the forward map. So the images can be lots of things, and these are kind of, I've worked on areas where, you know, you take a photograph and you're interested in optical reflectance, or I used to work in radio astronomy where people measure the radio brightness of the sky. I worked for the drilling industry measuring the electrical conductivity of mud under the ground, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a whole range of things that you could call the image. I usually use the term image recovery. I don't know why, it's just this process of estimating an image from this indirect data. So just to remind you a few things about forward problems and inverse problems, that the forward problem is the image to the data. In my case, there's a physical model for that, and I come from a physics background, so I assume, this is a kind of a thing that's usually, I mean, I don't think this is a novelty to you, but to statisticians, there's usually a novelty that we actually have a quantitative reason for giving a forward map, you know, to them. They model consumer confidence or something, and quite how you make a map from consumer confidence to something else, I don't know. So this is usually a novel point to them, but to us it's perfectly straightforward. The forward map involves a known computation, a direct computation that's well posed, and because there's one world, it's unique. And of course the inverse problem is implicit. It's implicitly defined, the solution that you're looking for. It's an indirect calculation, and in my case, it's never unique. Typically, an image is a continuous function of the variables, and we only ever have a finite amount of data, so the dimensionalities are different. You know, uniqueness is a thing that never exists. So we get that out of the system straight away. You know. So here's a little, an example of a measurement set, kind of an idealized measurement set for conductivity imaging. And you might be making a picture of the inside of your arm or something. And typically this consists by putting a number of electrodes around the object, and you push currents through the electrodes. And I've just shown a pair of currents being pushed through these pair of electrodes here, and measuring the voltage on another pair of electrodes. But in general, you have a bunch of electrodes around, you assert some vector of currents through those electrodes, you measure the voltages at the other electrodes, and from that you try and find the conductivity in the region. Now, of course, the forward map in this case is the solution of this Neumann problem, where internal to the region, given a conductivity, you know that the potential satisfies this elliptic operator. And this is really just a statement of conservation of current, you know, Ohm's law and conservation. And your data influences, or comes into this, because the boundary conditions are, in this Neumann problem, are the current that you assert. So, for instance, in this case, the current would be zero at places you don't have electrodes, and whatever the value you stick in through the electrode, for point electrodes, just for a simple case, is given by this boundary condition. And the measurements that you would make, typically you'd assert a particular set of currents, measure the voltages, assert another set of currents, measure the voltages. So you get these vector pairs of current and resulting voltages. And let's say you do that for n sets of currents. And of course the forward map says, given sigma, I can calculate all this stuff. You know, I can work out what all these current pairs are. And essentially this is a measurement of the Dirichlet-Neumann map, as Gunther would like to say. Actually it is. It's not even if Gunther would like to say it. So this is a discrete measurement of the Dirichlet-Neumann map. Oh, okay. Okay, thank you, Gunther. The Neumann-Dirichlet map, and from that we want to infer the PDE that's generated that map. Now, this is an interesting problem because the forward map requires solution of a linear problem. Not a linear relationship, but given sigma, you solve a linear PDE in phi. So it's quite a nice calculation. So it makes the calculation relatively straightforward. But the relationship of this, the way that the conductivity influences this Neumann-Dirichlet map is not linear. So the inverse problem is non-linear. So it's a kind of a first canonical problem, you know, where everything you do is linear except the problem is non-linear. In a certain sense, actually, you can understand the structure a little better because if you posed this as a, say, a finite element problem, and you wrote down a stiffness matrix, I think they call it, for this PDE, then you would assemble this conductivity into a matrix, and measuring the Neumann-Dirichlet map is like measuring a chunk of the inverse of the matrix. So that's like the structure of this problem. So imagine you're trying to measure a matrix and somebody tells you a small chunk of the inverse, can you get back to the original matrix? So that's the kind of nature of nonlinearity. Okay, so I'll look at some examples of conductivity imaging later. But let me just show you how you set this up as a statistical inverse problem. And here really is the whole deal. And it's just, you know, one of these block diagrams. Yeah. So here's our picture of the measurement process. And let me just talk you through this. So we start out here with a true image. So this is reality. Everything that we need to parameterize reality. So in our case, this is a continuous function of the variables that we're interested in. And the forward map consists of this process, or in our case, it's the relationship between the conductivity and this Neumann-Dirichlet map. Now, in our world, I'd call this ideal data or measurables or something. These are the things that you can measure. And typically, you don't actually measure those things. I mean, you've only got a finite number of measurements you can make, or you make choices about which measurements you're going to make or whatever. And so I think of this point here as being all possible measurable data. But in fact, you know, you've got some restriction to a finite dimensional space that is the actual data that you do measure. Now, in the statistical world, this is called data loss, which is kind of a silly word because it's not really loss of data. It's just, you know, you're not losing any. You've just chosen not to measure some things and not measure others. But in practice, you always have a finite amount of data, and so this is what I call the noise-free data that you measure. Now, as I say before, everything in the world has noise on it. You can't get away from it. And it's simplest just to model the noise as some additive process with some statistics. I don't, you know, we can talk about the statistics later. But certainly one of the things you need to do within this paradigm is you need to know both about the forward map and about the statistics of the noise that's added. So that's the thing. Okay, now to pop with, here is the actual data that you measure then. It's a discrete form. It's this true image gone through the forward map, projected in some way onto the measurables, and then you add noise to it. Now, the key thing about this is to note that the noise comes from some statistical distribution. You don't know what it is, otherwise you would subtract it. You know, and so it means that the data that you measure is also distributed, has some statistical distribution. And in fact, it's a statistical distribution that's parameterized by the thing that you're interested in, by the conductivity in this case. So in this world, measurements consist of drawing samples from a distribution which is parameterized by the thing that you're interested in. And that's a classical problem of inference. If you want to work out what this parameter is, that's a classical problem of statistical inference that statisticians have been doing for a long time. Actually, I would have to defend us mathematicians and say that Laplace actually did this first, so we can own it if we really want, you know. But I guess that's a side issue. Okay, so this is the structure of the problem. So we're drawing samples from a statistical distribution, and you want to estimate a parameter. Now, and so the estimation of that parameter is what we call, or I call, an image recovery algorithm. And it's clear to recognize that in cases like this, where, for instance, you've got a continuous image and finite amount of data, that if you're going to make an estimate of this thing, you have to put in some more information. But the problem is simply non-unique. And I think that's reasonably common. I'm sure in the seismic inversion case, you have many more parameters than data that you've measured. And of course, in real problems, it's often the case that the noise will push you outside the range of the forward map. I mean, that's often the case, that the forward map isn't onto your data space, so the noise pushes you outside the range. So typically this mapping is both overdetermined and underdetermined. So it's ill-posed in all the ways that you think. So you've got to put in some extra information into the image recovery algorithm. And we just take that for granted, a lot of image recovery algorithms, written based on some kind of computational routine, will often put information in implicitly. They'll do some computations and stop after, three or four iterations, because otherwise it's going to get bad, And so extra stuff is going in to construct the particular estimate, but I'm of the view you ought to be upfront about what you're sticking in and be explicit about the extra information you're putting in, and then compute exactly the thing, which is, can make a precise computation. So what's the nature of the information that you put in that we call prior knowledge? Well, it has various levels of kind of moral defendability. It could be physical constraints. Like if I'm making a picture of the sky brightness, I know there's no negative sky brightness, so I can defendably say it's positive. In general, for physics-y things, there's often groups of transformations that are invariant under, so those kind of things. We've seen quite a bit of regularization here, where, I put this down the moral list somewhere, that it's kind of a mathematical convenience because it gives you more smooth functions. I'm not sure that it really represents what a geophysicist would say about an image, that it really represents their preference for an image. You can plain put in preferences, I like pictures that have got cats in them, or whatever. And I should point out that there's a real continuum between prior knowledge and the basic step of modelling. I'm sure all of you have seen papers in which people choose to represent their image using the same number of parameters as the data they've measured, because then they get something invertible. I mean, that's, it's reprehensible but common. But that shows that basically the modelling part, the way that you choose to represent your image, can play the part of this prior knowledge as well. Okay, so just a little simple example. Let's say the noise is a Gaussian distribution with zero mean and some standard deviation, some variance. Then if it's additive like this, then it says that the data that we measure comes from a normal distribution where the mean is given by the operator acting on the forward map, acting on our image. So here's the parameter with that variance. So here is explicitly the distribution that we sample from, and we're trying to estimate this parameter. Now, the usual first step in this is to say, well, how can I quantify this fuzziness in image space? What's the likelihood, as it's called, of a particular image being true? Well, the way that works is you say, how likely is this image to be true? Well, what I do is I map it through the forward map. I see what noise is implied by assuming that image is true. And the likelihood of this image is the probability that the noise is true. So, if I choose an image out here that gets mapped to something which is way away from my data, I say, well, that's not very likely, because it implies that I had to have some noise that was extremely unlikely. But if it's very close, then I say it's more likely. So the likelihood function is really just the conditional probability of the data given the particular thing I'm interested in. Yeah? So it's just a probability of the noise implied by choosing this particular image. So the likelihood of an image is the probability that I got that data given the image. And for the Gaussian case, it's just this exponential like this. So here's an explicit form for it. Then the business of writing down a conditional density. So the conditional density for the image is given that I measured this particular piece of data, is just given by a standard manipulation of conditional densities by Bayes' rule, so-called. And incidentally, this was first invented by Laplace, so we can, And Bayes' rule just says that the conditional density for an image, given that you made a measurement, is this likelihood function multiplied by what we call a prior, a density of over images, divided by the probability of the data. And for our, once you've made a measurement, this is a constant, so it's just a normalizing constant, and we ignore this. So this really is the place that we start. This Bayes rule, it says that you can quantify the ambiguity in the images because it's equal to the product of the likelihood and the prior. Now, I should say some things about this. A lot of people, I don't know whether people here are worried particularly about the role of priors. I got to say that I'm not really kind of worried about the philosophical thing aspect of this. I believe in a kind of a utility of this thing. There's a great utility in using Bayes' rule, including the ability to fuse very large data sets from very different sources. There's a straightforward rule in which you can apply this and compute things accurately. I think to mathematicians, all I've got to say is that the prior is can be made uniform in an appropriate choice of space. That Laplace... He decided he couldn't work out what to do with the prior, so he made it uniform. He has this principle of insufficient reason. But of course, the distributions have a functional value up to the measure that's used, and under a change of variables, the functional form changes. And so, with an appropriate choice of functions, you can make this uniform. So Laplace was right and he's wrong. I mean, it's kind of a silly thing to say you ought to make this uniform because that's really telling you about your choice of variables. So we shouldn't get so uptight about the existence of a prior. It's really about the choice of the variables that I use to represent my image. So when you realise this thing, you realise it's not a big deal, actually. So, as I say, my main interest in using this formula is kind of a pragmatic thing, and it turns out that by including prior knowledge or modelling, whichever way you want to say it, we're able to include kinds of high-level information that a geophysicist or an expert or something might want to put into their pictures. And in particular, like yesterday, I saw Larry gave a little cartoon of a forward and inverse problem, in which the image that he ended up with was a picture in terms of layers of rock type beneath the surface. And for instance, we could directly have prior information that says that the image that we're looking for is made up of rock types within some kind of range of morphs or so. Okay, so what do we do with this thing? Here's the conditional density. So really, this is the start and the end of the Bayesian part of it. Bayesians should formally say, okay, this thing contains all the information that I know about the image, given that I've measured some data. And if you want to know everything that the Bayesian knows, they give this to you. But often images are, 1,000 by 1,000 pixels or something. So this is a million dimensional object, And so here's a function over a million dimensions. I wouldn't do that to anybody, given this function. So imaging, as we know it in the Bayesian world, consists of summarizing this distribution in some way, of calculating statistics which summarize the information that's in this high dimensional object. So this is really what they are. Solutions are summary statistics. So that's what you've got to do. So all information is calculated in this prior distribution. It's this density here that says you pick an image and I'll tell you how likely it is. Okay. Now, the traditional solutions that have been used are the modes of the distribution, and we've seen cases like that today. For instance, the maximum likelihood, if you set the prior to be uniform, you might maximize the posterior distribution, this thing here. And in that case, you're just maximizing the likelihood function. So it's the thing that maximizes the likelihood. Or you can include the prior distribution and maximize the a posteriori distribution, as it's called, and you get this map estimate. So these are looking for the places where the data fit is the best, up to either a non-regularized, in the current language, either a non-regularized or a regularized solution. So for instance, for a Gaussian prior, and the Gaussian noise before, you get exactly this formulation. If you just take the logarithm of this statement, then the map estimate is the thing that minimizes the sum of squares misfit plus alpha into some regularizing term. And this sigma squared comes because of this Gaussian prior. Okay, so in this world, Tikhonov regularization, we would say, is a map estimate using a Gaussian prior. And of course, you've seen all these things that, as I say, it's called Tikhonov regularization, or in a certain world, it's called Kalman filtering if you do it sequentially, with appropriate ways of choosing this Lagrange multiplier. It's the Backus-Gilbert. You take alpha to zero, it's the thing we call the Moore-Penrose, or the generalized inverse. Alpha being zero, of course, you get rid of this term, it's least squares. So it's all of these things. So I'll show you some examples of maximum likelihood and map estimates, and I'll show you why you shouldn't use those things for lots of cases. So one of the good things about taking the noise into account explicitly is you can work out exactly how do these things perform, and it turns out that in high-dimensional problems like image processing, they're not a good idea. Now, in the probability sense, the way that you should calculate answers to your questions are by expectations over this distribution of possible images. So, for instance, if I had a function that sits on top of an image, can take an image and says, this person has a cancer, or not, you know, whatever, what's the given the data, what's the expected value of a cancer? Well, it's an expectation over my posterior distribution of the function that says they've got a cancer. Okay, so here's how I should answer that question. Now there's a real implication about that for high-dimensional problems. And let me just show you. I've drawn a little posterior distribution here with a couple of bumps. So here's P of sigma given to my data. Here's phi down here, or sigma, I should say. And I want to calculate this expectation here. And the key thing to note is that if I'm calculating the integral of P into f of sigma d sigma, if I'm in a high-dimensional space, like I'm doing image processing, then there are a lot more metric terms than there are function terms in this integral. Yeah? So let's say I'm making a cruddy image. It's a 10 by 10 pixel image, so, you know, cruddy. And it has 100 parameters in there. Okay, so this thing here is d sigma 1, d sigma 2, d sigma 3, and so on up to d sigma 100. Now, where should I pick in this values of sigma so that I best estimate this integral if I'm going to pick a single value? Well, the traditional solution says you pick the mode. Okay, you pick the value that's largest here. But let's say the distribution has another mode, and just for argument's sake, let's say this mode is two times wider than this mode here, and let's say it's two times wider in each of the sigma directions. So it's two times wider this way, that way. Okay, so it picks up a factor of 2 to the 100 for this term here. And how much does this one pick up? Well, let's say it's 2 times higher than this one. This pick up a factor of 2. Now, you'll spot that 2 to the 100 is bigger than 2. And for high-dimensional problems, you know, if you've got a 1,000 by 1,000 image, this could be 2 to the million versus 2. And what it tells you is if you want to calculate expectations, the value of the function really is irrelevant. You really want a place where the curvature of the function is maximized. People in stats would call this the Fisher information. They would say you maximize the Fisher information. Now, I've drawn a little example here with two bumps like this, but it doesn't even have to be two bumps. It could have gone like this. The distribution could have just been skewed, and it just gets fatter in each of the dimensions as it goes down. You know, so here I've got a little peak, and as it goes down the hill, it just gets fatter in each of the sigma directions. Okay, all of the probability mass, by a factor of 2 to the 100 to 2, so I claim that's a lot, is over here. Yeah? And so what it's saying is that the bulk of feasible solutions, the place where you would maximize this expectation, bulk of feasible solutions are the place where you should get these metric factors large, and really the value of the function in high-dimensional cases is largely irrelevant. So it says that these map solutions and maximum likelihood solutions are kind of flawed because you're unlikely to be representing the majority of solutions by using these, except if you're in one of these cases where, for instance, you've got continuous variables and the posterior distribution is a nice symmetric thing like a Gaussian, in which case the mode of the distribution is the mean, you know, and you're unlikely to do better than pick the center value. But I claim that in these high-dimensional problems, unless you really know you're in this case, then the modes are a bad idea. And let me show you some examples of that. So let me first of all show you some examples of modes, because they're nice pictures. So here's some examples of just Fourier deconvolution. These are some things that we get our grad students to crank out and a course on inverse problems, you know, they all enjoy them. I enjoy them too. Okay, so here's an image that's been blurred with a point spread function that's a circle of radius 5 or something like that. So you can see you start off with a blurry image. We tell our students the point spread function and the blurred image, and they rush away and calculate the exact inverse because they know about Fourier deconvolution. Oh, we've added a touch of noise to this as well, you know. So they rush away and calculate the exact inverse, and this is the thing they get here, you know, and they realize, oh, you don't really want to do an exact inverse. And of course, what's going on is the small singular values, the noise in the directions of the smalls. Oh, the singular vectors with small singular value are being blown up, and it produces this crud. If you use a bit of least squares regularizing, so, you know, I badmouth it a little bit, but actually I use it, you can calculate a map solution. So this would be least Gaussian prior, or least squares regularizing, Tychonoff regularizing, whatever you want to call it, with the regularizing parameter chosen according to the L curve. So I presume everybody here has read Per Christian Hansen's book on numerical linear inversion and knows about the L-curve, knows how to drive these algorithms, and has the sweet little programs in MATLAB that does it all. Well, here you are. Okay. Now, this is a case where it turns out that an inverse exists because the number of pixels in my measurement is the number of pixels in my image. I've got another case over here where I've just thrown away half of the data. So what I did was I blurred an image and then randomly took half of the points and chucked them away. And of course, there's no inverse in this case, but you can use regularized deconvolution and still get a decent image out of it. And of course, here is a case where you certainly wouldn't want to represent your image using the same number of points as your data, because of course you can get a decent image by doubling the number of points. And you know, here's something that's useful. So here's some examples of maximum likelihood and maximum a posteriori estimates in the cases where the variables are continuous and the noise is Gaussian. So we're in this case here where the mode is the same as the mean and it's probably the best estimate you're going to make. Now let me show you a case where I break one of those things. And in this case, all I'm going to do is I'm going to break the part of it being continuous. Okay, I'm not even going to skew the distribution. I'm just going to break the distribution being continuous. Okay, so it's over a discrete distribution. But I claim, actually there's a little bit of a conjecture, so I should make it clear, that if you break any one of these things, that you have a nonlinear Ford map, a discrete state space, or non-Gaussian noise, then all bets are off about the maximum likelihood solution, or the least square solution, being representative of the bulk of feasible images. So here's a little case that I quite like. So I think this is a 24 by 24 image or something, 16 by 16 image that's black and white. So the state space here is Z2 to the 16 squared, something like that. Yeah, so it's a discrete space. And what I've done is I've blurred it by additive noise on each pixel, which is Gaussian. So it takes it outside that space, turns it into a space of real numbers. And my job is to find the point in Z2 to the 16 squared that makes a good reconstruction given this noisy data here. Okay. Now, the reason I've chosen this is it turns out you can do the optimization for map. There's a convergent algorithm for doing this optimization. You know, normally discrete optimization on hypercubes like this is a difficult thing. In fact, but it turns out for this problem, there's a convergent algorithm, and I can tell you this is the map solution. It turns out this algorithm was discovered in an attempt to find some people were calculating maximum likelihood or max a posteriori solutions. And there was some question about whether algorithms were actually converging or not, and that's why this algorithm was discovered or how it was discovered. But I guess that's not really the point. So what I've done here is I've plotted the map solution for Gaussian priors that have first derivative penalty. So in fact, it's an Ising model, but you could speak of that as being a Gaussian prior with first derivative, a discrete approximation to that. And this theta that I've put down here is just the smoothing parameter. And then I've calculated a bunch of other things over here, and I'll indicate how I calculated these later. But here is the mean distribution for this blur of images. Here is a single sample from that distribution. And here's a statistic. It turns out to be the marginal posterior mean. So it's a kind of squared up version of the mean, but let me tell you that. Okay. Now, I'm not claiming that the mean, of course, is a reconstruction, because it doesn't even live in the correct space for a reconstruction. But all I want to do is show you the mean so you can get an idea where the bulk of feasible images are and what do they look like. And I've given you a sample to show that really is what samples look like. I've just picked a sample from at random with the distribution of the posterior distribution. So here's a sample at random, and look, they really do look like the mean. You know, it's not that the distribution's bimodal and the samples don't look like the mean or anything. They really do look like the mean. But look at the MAP solution here, or the maximum likelihood when you're up here, and notice that in many cases, like down here with large smoothing and so forth, you would certainly have to say that the MAP solution is not representative of the bulk of feasible images. Okay, I don't care whether you think these are good reconstructions or not, that's not really the issue. I think there are better statistics for calculating good reconstructions, but that's not really the point. Okay, so the mean tells you where the bulk of feasible images are, what they look like, and notice that in this high-dimensional problem where the only thing I broke was discreteness, the mode of the distribution, really you could not claim as representative of the bulk of feasible images. Yeah? So if you use regularization and you have a problem with a Ford map's nonlinear, or the state space is discrete, or your noise is non-Gaussian, then it's unlikely, to very high probability, that calculating the maximum, the least squares fit, for instance, or the regularized inverse, is going to get you something that truly represents the range of solutions that are allowed by your data, okay, that are consistent with your data. Okay, so let's hope that what that tells you. Well, let me just, okay, well, so what I want to do is just show you a little more formally about the conductivity imaging problem. And I'll just kind of scoot through this and give you an idea of how I calculated these means and so forth. Okay. So here's a... Yeah.
What is the organization that you're using in that solution?
This is an Ising model. Does that mean something to you? Yeah. So I've got a pixel image there, and it likes... This pixel here likes to be like its neighbours. So it's... Yeah. So it's this minus this squared, yeah, and summed over neighbours. So you could view that as a first derivative. So it's a discrete in the discrete world. It's a first derivative regularizer.
That's not very good. The regularization, there's something edgy there.
You know, you have no, I agree. I agree completely. And were I trying to make a better reconstruction, then there are things like Badley's delta loss in the statistics world, which specifically... I mean, there's bad things about this pixel representation because it has a preference for X and Y, you know. I'm not claiming this is a good reconstruction. Okay, I just want to show you an example. Okay. So let me just quickly show you this Bayesian formulation. It really is not too important. I'll just show you the basic framework that, you know, things are straightforward. And all I do is I write down all the variables that this, the current in the region, the potential in the region, and the conductivity. So these are variables that completely represent the state of the space. The things that I actually measure are the voltage and currents at electrodes. And so what I do is I write down the joint posterior distribution for the conductivity being a particular value. This little n refers to which current set I'm applying, so that the potential and the currents in the region are something. Given that I measured the data, well, you just apply Bayes' rule. So it's equal to the likelihood function. So the probability that I have these measurements given these internal parameters multiplied by the probability of these internal parameters. Now, in my case, this is not really an arbitrary representation because there's some physics that relates various of these parameters. So, for instance, the current is equal to the conductivity by the gradient of the potential. So I have a little bit of physics. And also, I can work out the potential by a map from the current on the boundary. So all I really want to point out to you is that this is not... I don't get to choose this representation arbitrarily. There's a little bit of physics that says I'm really only allowed to choose things on the boundary, but let's not worry about that too much. As it turns out, I'm only interested in the distribution of the conductivity, and so I'm only going to stipulate the distribution, the prior for the conductivity, and usually I make it a Markov random field, like this Ising model or something else. I wish I had a bit more time to talk about this modelling issue, but maybe later. So the likelihood, then, is the other term. So here's the prior. I've specified the prior distribution. I need to write down the likelihood. And in this case, the likelihood for these measurements, given the various internal parameters, I can use the conditional independence to separate the distribution for the voltage and current measurements, because the voltage only depends on the true voltage in the region. The current that I measure only depends on the true current. So there's a little bit of a simplification. And if the errors, for instance, are independent, identically distributed, then it's just the product over separate measurements. And if I had an explicit form for my noise process, Gaussian or whatever, I'd have an explicit function here. Okay, so I've specified the prior. This is my modelling step. I can specify the nature of the function I want to represent or whatever. This is my knowledge of the noise process, the likelihood, so away we go. That's everything you need to set up for the Bayesian formulation.
Can we apply our own the sigma? Could this be uniform?
Well, in this case, for conductivity imaging, as you probably well know, for a given, as I suspect you know, for a given level of noise, there's only a finite amount of data that you get through the forward map. And typically, for you know reasonable measurements with 0.1% accuracy, there's about 100 things you get through the forward map. So if your image has more than 100 pixels or 100 numbers to represent it, then you've got to put something else in. So you can't really use uniform. You do have to resolve the ambiguity in the image. Now, in this case, I've used a prior, an icing model as well, and I thought I'd just show you some samples from the prior to give you an idea of what they look like. So here's a sample from an icing model with the smoothing parameter that I chose, about 1, it's not important. And you'll see that it basically like things that are blobby and kind of have X and Y structure about them. If you're doing real modelling, you'd be better off using a different prior. I'm not claiming this is a good reconstruction. Our favourite, perhaps I should just say, is to use a representation which is a random triangulation of the plane. So we have a process that instead of an icing model that produces pixel images like this, it produces a random triangulation of the plane, you know, it's put down, and the number of triangles is random, and we put a process on this that says that adjacent, we colour the triangles and say that adjacent triangles like to be like each other. The position of these nodes are part of the random process. We can normalise this distribution. We know an explicit normalising function for random triangulations of the plane, and so this is actually our favourite representation. And the reason is when you're doing image analysis and stuff, and this is a scene of crops or whatever, it's good to be able to identify collinear things and roads and so forth. But
it's your knowledge of the physics. Is that, when you said be next to one another, I think of the fact that if I'm going to let them, I'm not likely to pick my pen.
Yeah, exactly. So this I say is part of our prior model, but really it's part of the modelling process. It's something, you know, it's our representation of the state includes, you know, knowledge of what it is. Well, another example we give our students, I mentioned to Steve earlier on, is we give them a picture of a microscope slide with some good and bad cells in it, you know, like this. And we ask them to write a sampler, an inverse thing, that tells them how many good cells and how many bad cells. And in that case, we give them a template for a good cell and a group of transformations that it's allowed to undergo, translation and shifting and blobbing and things, and likewise for bad cells, and that's their representation. So it's a random number of cells of each given type with positions and so forth. So this is a variable dimension model because the number of things in it can change and go up and down, and the positions and so forth. So that would be their representation in that case. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I forgot to scoot along. So let me tell you how you calculate these expectations, and I'll do it. Am I over time?
Or? Five, 10 minutes.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. So this is the way that you calculate these expectations, and it's a little bit of a surprise, I guess, that in these high-dimensional cases, the best way to calculate the integrals are by Monte Carlo integration. You know, in low dimensions, you think that's a terrible idea. But in these high-dimensional cases, you really do only want to be picking samples from places where the function is large. You know, if I've got 100 dimensions and I use a grid method, you know, and I put 2 samples in each direction, which is pretty crummy, I've got 2 to the 100 samples, and probably none of them are in places where the function is large. You know, but if I sample from the distribution itself, If I can draw a bunch of samples that come from the distribution, then I can calculate these expectations approximately as sums over the function evaluated samples that I have. So that's just Monte Carlo integration. So really, the key to this whole business is to generate a sequence of samples distributed according to this posterior distribution. And the way we do that, or the current technology, is to generate a Markov chain. So essentially a random walk in image space that has the property that asymptotically the distribution of this walk is as the posterior distribution. So I'm going to choose the properties of the random walk so that the frequency it spends at any place is proportional to this probability density. Now that's a well-known process. And this is essentially how it goes. This is the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm that we use. So you generate a sequence of states, and how do you do it? Well, here's one iteration of the process. What it says, if you've given a state sigma t at time t, you generate some candidate state from a proposal distribution. Now, your proposal distribution could be anything. In the image that I have over here, I could pick a pixel at random and change its value. That's it. That's all my proposal distribution. It doesn't have to be anything clever. Okay. And then I either accept or reject that with this probability here. And this is what's called the Metropolis-Hastings acceptance. So it's a ratio of the likelihoods and the posteriors and this proposal distribution. And if I do that, if I accept it, I change the state to my proposal. If I don't accept it, I keep the state as the old one. And I keep doing that. And that's enough to do this thing. And the proposal distribution can be anything as long as it's irreducible and aperiodic. It could be irreducible is just really a kind of probabilistic connectedness argument, and aperiodic is as it says. Now, you can use this algorithm to do anything. You can write a program that spits out random chess positions where the probability of each state that it gives you is according to the number of moves it took to get there, you know? You can use this for anything. It's great.
It comes
in on wind. Okay. So here's a Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. Now, I could show you about the details of that algorithm. I think the thing I should say to this audience is that this thing is guaranteed asymptotic convergence, but if you want to make it work well, this proposal distribution better know about the structure of your forward problem. And I think really the key issue is you want to be, if you've got ambiguity in some part of the state, you really want to be exploring that. You know, so if we know that your forward map has some kind of invisibility in it, some kind of structures you're not able to see, those are precisely the things you want to be trying to make moves into so that you sample the part of space where your image is ambiguous. So let me just show you some examples quickly doing this. These are 24 by 24 images, and I'm just going to show you a few of these to give you a little bit of a sense of the kind of modelling and what you can do. So here's a three conductivity example. So I know my state, my representation says each pixel is allowed to be one of three conductivities. And here's the truth here. So it's a low value, a medium, and a high conductivity. I've run the chain for a while, and I've just picked, once it's reached, I start this chain from a random state, I should say. So there's, you know, we're guaranteed convergence, so I'm allowed to start anywhere. I wait till the chain has converged and has converged to the prior posterior distribution. I've just pulled out a couple of samples to show you what they look like. So these are what feasible images look like. Over that sequence, I can calculate the mean image. I know in this case it's not a state, but I'm just showing you what it is. So you see the mean image captures some of the structure of the original here. But more than that, I can actually calculate the variance of this mean as well. I can tell you where does my process know that the image is well-defined and where is it not well-defined. And I've drawn variance as dark things here. So you can see, for instance, there's a high variance along this edge because this measurement process couldn't determine the value along this edge well. So not only can I give you an estimate, I can tell you how well I know it. Okay, so that's important. Here's a continuous variable case in which I've got three conductivity types. And each type is allowed to have a range of values. So here's the true value. So it has three conductivity types, and each one has a slightly different value. So this could be bone, blood, and muscle. I know is in my arm. And each one I know has a range of allowable values. And my state in this case is a type variable. So here's a state that just says what type is this pixel. And over here, given a type, it says this is what the conductivity is. Now, on the type variable, I have an Ising model that says if one pixel is the type, so should the next one be. But of course, this one allows a variation in values. So this would be a kind of thing you'd use for seismic inversion. You'd have the type of rock under the ground and then the allowable values for that. Here's a mean image and a variance again. So I can calculate, have a process that generates these things according to the posterior distribution. Another little one is just this example of shielding. So here's a little three conductivity case, two different cases here. One where I have a medium, low, and high conductivity, and here I have a low, medium, and high conductivity. And so you get kind of shielding of this conductivity on the inside by this region outside. It turns out one of these you can image well. I can see that I get a good reconstruction here. So here's a state, a reconstruction. And here's my variance that says, okay, and I know that I know this well, because it says, look, I've got the conductivity around here well, here well. Okay, I don't quite know where this inside boundary is, but I know the conductivity as well. In this case, I couldn't image, and furthermore, I know I can't image it because my variances are large everywhere. One thing I wanted to mention was that the complexity of the forward model is really not an issue in this, and we work with a group in Finland who produces detailed finite element models that conform with the data of conductivity imaging very well. And here's a little case where I had a blob here, and here's just a sample, for instance, from our routine. And I plotted a couple of curves here. This one is the prior distribution, so how well I like this image. And again, it's an Ising-style prior. And here is the likelihood. So this is what you'd call the least squares fit, or chi-squared, people would call it. And the main thing I want you to see here is that as I iterate this process, the likelihood is fit very quickly. Okay? It takes a lot longer to make the image nice. So there are lots of states here that are very likely, that are close to the data, that are good least squares solutions. What other words do I need to say? That are close to the maximum that you would get through optimization, but that don't represent good states. So this is a measure of the ill-posedness of the system. Okay, so my conclusions. The bottom line I want to say to you is that you should take into account noise, and if you use this process, up to some issues that you still need to be clever how to design these algorithms. If you can simulate the forward map, then you can sample the posterior distribution and calculate expectations. So that means you can solve the inverse problem. Okay. Another message I want you to get is the single most likely image is often not a good reconstruction. Okay. That I believe that image recovery should be the process of summarizing the bulk of feasible images. I think that's what you ought to do. You know, I think that's our job. And statistical inference gives you a unifying way. And I thought I'd just end up by a statistician who I don't like at all, and perhaps I should mention is dead now. So that he once said, well, what's all this business about inverse problems? What's so important? You know, after all, the forward problem is just probability, and the inverse problem is just statistics. And as it turns out, I agree with them, but I don't wish to agree with them very loudly. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Maybe if there's just one or two quick questions.
I would like to share our experience in tissue conductivity modeling looking in the human body. And we have published a lot of papers in Transactions of Biomedical Engineering. What we do is, like for example, with like a deep fibrillation study, you apply electrodes on the body, and we fold in the MRI images of the domain and then apply inverse techniques, not that much statistical modeling as you have done. We certainly would like to incorporate that. However, we have been able to reconstruct tissue conductivities and the maps of the domain too, with like in the chest area, something like 25 tissue types, and in the head area, about 13 tissue types, and they come out to be very good. However, in real life situations, things change all the time. Human body conductivity.
Yeah, if people are alive. They have a
every moment,
they like to move and stuff.
Drink coffee. So what we do is for real-life modeling where we are applying like EEG, MEG, or ECG, MCG, we take the blood samples at the time we take the measurement. Then we can sync the conductivity of the blood
to that sample
as a reference point, and that comes out to be very good. So this is just a sort of like a thing I was trying to share what we have been doing. And what I can see is that I could learn something from you using some of these statistical approaches, perhaps we can further improve what we are doing. And the other thing was that once we extract the domains, often they don't come out to be very good, similar to like your shape of faith. What we do is we just apply the thinning or bloating algorithms to enhance the domains. And since we have the MRI images, so we can sort of iterate back and
forth.
Something like that.
As it turns out, we have a group at Auckland who does very similar work, the kind that you're talking about, and I do occasionally make contact with them, and I'm aware that one of the issues of these algorithms is that they are slow, because it's this, that, I mean, for instance, for these PDE problems, like the conductivity image, you need to solve the PDE at every time you make an adjustment to your state, and so that's typically hundreds of thousands or millions of times. And we do have algorithms that make that very efficient. As it turns out, they're all order constant in the pixel account, so that's, you know, it makes them no more expensive than a linear forward map, but they're still way too slow for the kind of clinical applications that, that our group in Auckland, I presume, that you want to use them for. So there's a lot of work to be done yet.
Are you talking about Peter Pinkers?
Exactly.
Yeah, I know all about.
So.
Perhaps we can thank. If I could suggest, we're about half hour behind time, and because people might have flights or something to catch, if we could keep our coffee break.